This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. We acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woiwurrung and Boiwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past, present and emerging. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia, where our broadcast reaches. Hey everyone, and thank you so much for tuning in to the Climate Action Show, either on 3CR tonight or Skid Row. You are with Bella tonight. With summer coming up, there are heaps and heaps of festivals and live music events up and coming across Australia. These live music events really help to make up Australia's very rich and diverse arts and music culture, as well as bring communities and people together. Like every community-centered space, festivals and live music are at risk from the increasing extreme and unpredictable weather caused by climate change. So like flash flooding, fires, heat waves, these are all resulting in an increasing insurance cost for festivals, possible cancelling and rescheduling of these festivals, and higher ticket costs for consumers. It's causing a change in ticket purchasing behaviour, and as a result, it's causing a decrease in overall festivals here in Australia. And as said before, these are really important community and culture building and bonding spaces. So later in the show, I'm going to be talking with Shay, who's new to our Climate Action team. This is going to be her first show live with us, which is really exciting. And I'm super excited for it, so you guys should be too. And we're going to be talking a bit about a few festivals that are, their whole focus is centered around sustainability and keeping festivals eco-friendly, which quite often they are not. I did speak about how they're quite under threat from climate change, but they're also quite a large contributor themselves. So how we can make these spaces, especially community spaces, more community oriented and more sustainable. So we'll be discussing that later. So stay tuned. But first up, we're lucky enough to be joined by Tim Scheel, so Green Music Australia's community organiser, to talk about how Green Music Australia's recent report from earlier this year, the Rain, Heat, Repeat report, and how its findings on how consumer behaviour with festivals and climate change informs us how extreme weather can and will further affect live music events, as well as solutions we need to action in order to save festivals from extinction, amongst many other things. Until then, though, we have a few announcements, so stay tuned for all we've got going on tonight.
The law is part of our everyday lives, including when we buy something, use a service, have a job, or rent a house. The law can be used to help protect and support families when there is violence in the home or disputes over parenting arrangements. Sometimes we might need to understand the law to navigate specific government systems like Centrelink, getting a residency visa, or if we come into contact with the police. Community legal centres provide free, quality legal advice and assistance to help people with everyday legal problems. We focus on working with people who are experiencing disadvantage, such as financial hardship, family violence, homelessness, and discrimination. Community legal centres are independent, non-government organisations and can be found across Victoria and Australia. If you're experiencing a legal problem, your local community legal centre may be able to help. To find a community legal centre near you, visit the Federation of Community Legal Centres Victoria at www.fclc.org.au. A 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Anika Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You are listening to the Climate Action Show on 3CR or the Community Broadcast Network. Tonight, and you're here with Bella. Luckily, we've got our interview with Tim Shield from Green Music Australia now, talking about their recent report, Rain, Heat and Repeat. Thank you so much, first of all, Tim, for joining me tonight. Sorry, a bit of technology issues, but thank you so much, Tim, for being able to join me tonight. It's really great to have you on board.
Hey, no worries. How you doing?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm sitting in my backyard, and it's looking, you know, a little grey overhead, but we'll see how we hold out. If you hear the sounds of me scrambling, it's because it's starting to rain and I'm getting out of it.
All good. All good. So if you could you give us a bit of a brief overview about what the Green Music Australia organisation is and what it is that you guys do?
Absolutely. And I'll try and be brief. We've been together as an organisation. We're a non-for-profit, a registered charity. We've been going since 2013. It was started by another guy called Tim, actually, a viola player from Canberra called Tim Hollow, who was very passionate about the environment, wanted to see action on climate, and at the time kind of felt like the music community had a lot to offer but wasn't maybe organized or wasn't potentially resourced to work towards climate action. So yeah, he kind of built it from scratch. He started talking to his friends, he started talking to people working in the music industry, venues, festivals, record labels. Eventually it grew, so we've now got a small staff. It's about four or five of us, depending on which way you try and count it. And yeah, we essentially try and do two things. One is that we aim to be the place that the music industry or the music sector can come if they want to, you know, go green or implement sustainable policies. We try and do a lot of the research and build the resources for venues, festivals, labels, vinyl manufacturers, whoever it might be, so they can take the steps towards, you know, being greener. And that's really only like one side of what we do as an organization. The other side is just this growing realization I think we all have that, you know, to fix, as if we can just fix it, but, you know, to address a climate and address all of these big kind of social issues that we have at the moment, it actually requires a bit of change in hearts and minds, a bit of a change in behavioural mindset, and that music and musicians as storytellers, as leaders in their communities, are often really well positioned to lead change on social issues. So, you know, that's the other side of what we do is quite unique to music and unique to, I guess, cultural practice, which is to say that, you know, we can make change happen through building community and through telling different kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I also think it's super interesting it being focused on music, because I think that is so true, the ability for music to speak to people. I guess, especially when I guess maybe science can't, I guess music is maybe a bit more of a universal thing people understand. And if they see their favourite artists getting behind a cause, they also will.
I think so. Yeah, I think that's part of it. Like, it's definitely true that we like, as an organisation, we have worked with some artists that have pretty big platforms or can speak pretty loudly. And when those artists speak up on an issue they care about, it can influence a lot of people. Like, on the global stage, for example, you know, Billie Eilish and Coldplay are these, like, massive mainstream figures that are quite outspoken on climate issues in particular and environmental issues. And people for whom like climate activism and social, like progressive social ideas maybe are just not in their day-to-day lives, Billie Eilish or Coldplay making a gesture in that direction will actually touch those people, or will actually kind of reach into their lives potentially. But yeah, also if you just think about traditionally the role of music and the role of culture in human society, like music predates language. Like it is sort of at the core of our being as humans to respond to melody, to respond to the emotion in music, and to respond to stories that are told through music, the history of folk music, the history of song lines. So, you know, to kind of put music at the heart and put culture at the heart of climate action is really just to acknowledge like how crucial these technologies, these like ancient technologies of culture making are for forming reality, you know, forming our worldview.
Definitely. And I guess that goes to like, I guess another point I was interested in, because I understand that in the scheme of everything, having the risk of festivals and live music events being threatened almost seems very like minuscule, and not that it doesn't matter, but it doesn't seem as big of an issue as, I guess, in terms of how climate change will pose a risk to people's livelihoods, livable places, cost of living. So I guess why would losing music festivals and live music events in Australia be an actual terrible event?
I know what you mean. Because yeah. I think, you know, when you look at like, you know, at the moment we've been focusing a bit more on there's been a bit of talk around like Pacific leadership because COP has come up for COP30, which your listeners will be really familiar with, I'm sure. And this idea that we may have COP in our part of the world next year, and that we could have a Pacific-led COP, and we could kind of raise to the fore a lot of the issues in that, you know, in our part of the world, essentially our neighbours. You know, these are countries that they like their very livelihood, their, you know, cultures, their traditions, their way of lives are just going to potentially evaporate. Like that's just one example of the kind of horrific outcomes of decades of human-made, you know, climate change. And so to sort of say like, oh, a couple of music festivals might get cancelled, it can seem a little bit like, you know, like not such a big deal. And I think, again, it kind of just goes back to like trying to meet people where they're at in their lives. You know, in Australia, the reality is that for a lot of young people, over the last couple of decades, like going to music festivals, particularly outdoor music festivals, is a rite of passage. It is it's not everyone that does it, but a lot of young people do. They go to these music festivals, they form memories, they deepen relationships with their friends, they indulge in whatever it is they might indulge in, and they experience like the joy of music. And yeah, I mean, there is research to show that all of that is at risk, and you've got festivals either postponing or just shutting down entirely because of the rising costs of insurance, among other kind of risks that they can't take on anymore. And so, you know, we would never say like, oh, losing a music festival's the worst outcome of the climate crisis, but it can be a place to onboard people into the seriousness of what's happening, you know, is just to remind people that the things that they love are in danger, you know, or not just in danger, but they are transforming in front of our eyes. The things that we think of as part of our lives, as part of our joy, as part of our identity, like, you know, any way that we can to kind of onboard people onto the urgency of the moment, I think is valuable. So that's one way that we can do that with music, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I definitely agree. And I think, I definitely agree when it stems back to music festivals and live music events are really big community building spaces, especially for young people, as you said.
They can be. At their best, they are, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah. At their best, yeah. So I wanted to speak a little bit too about the report that Green Music Australia kind of put out. That was the Rain, Heat, Repeat report. From my understanding as well, you were at the stalls and festivals last summer collecting survey responses from punters for the report. Were there any kind of like common sentiments you kind of felt or heard from these survey responses?
Yeah, it was interesting. Like, so we, you know, for that report, we collated a whole bunch of survey responses from music festival attendees, mm-hmm. and specifically it was like a handful of events we were at. We were at the Lime Cordial tour last year, national tour. We were on Billie Eilish's tour this year at all of her gigs in Australia. And we were also, oh, it is raining, and we were also at a couple of music festivals, including Party in the Paddock in Tasmania. And, yeah, I mean, I think one of the key findings of that report is that, you know, most young people are extremely aware of the climate crisis and are not surprised by the amount of festivals that are shutting down and are not surprised to learn about some of the risks of extreme heat and the way it's going to increase in such a staggering way in the years to come, you know. Mm-hmm. And it, sometimes it can feel really frustrating that we have to keep reminding people that, you know, this is not... Everyone knows, like we all know, that something needs to be done. So I think our report is just like one more report that gets added to, you know, the pile that you hope tips the balance for people who are potentially decision makers about, mm-hmm. you know, where to direct funds, where to direct energy in the years to come. One thing I did notice that I found interesting because I'm, you know, I'm kind of Melbourne through and through. I'm like a proper Narm boy, and I get to Tassie sometimes, but not as much as I would like. Mm. And it was really being at Party in the Paddock specifically for a few days and talking to all of the young attendees of that festival, which is a pretty mainstream festival. There is something about, I think, the history of the Tasmanian environmental movement that means that some of these ideas are just in the DNA, even generationally. So that was really interesting to talk to a bunch of like 18, 19, 20-year-olds who weren't necessarily full-time climate activists, but all had a very basic understanding of environmental issues and of climate advocacy. And that's because, yeah, it's been a bit more maybe front of mind politically, in Tasmania, in state politics, and just the identity of the state itself, wrapped up in, you know, deforestation and regenerative practice, and so yeah, I found that really interesting. You know, it's easy to forget how you know informed we are by our kind of local circumstance.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Yeah, because I guess, like, as you said, there's a lot of environmental activism history in Tasmania. Mm. Yeah, that's super interesting, though. Also in the report as well, there was a bit that was highlighted that 81% of people think governments are not doing enough to protect the music scene from climate impacts, which I guess kind of goes back to what you were kind of hearing from these surveys, responses. I guess what should protection from the government look like for the Australian music scene from climate change?
It's a really good question and one that's quite complicated to answer clearly.
Yeah, no, that's fair.
because it's all about, you know, I think different sections of the music sector would answer it differently, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Many of our biggest festivals are continuing to kind of lobby government for subsidised funding, and much of it is due to some of these insurance issues that they're facing, that they're sort of seeing the insurance companies that have helped them run their events over the years are seeing the writing on the wall. They understand that floods and extreme heat are much more likely in the years to come, and they, in order to cover the risk of what could happen to punters at a festival, those premiums are going up. So a lot of those festivals are either just straight up asking for state and federal funding to just increase, like to subsidise them running their event at all. Mm-hmm. Some people are looking at insurance reform as well and like finding alternatives and different ways of calculating the risk. I mean, all of that's pretty boring.
Yeah.
but it's an important conversation, I guess, at that end of the music sector. But I think I found interesting about that stat in particular is I think two things. One is that I think if you ask most young people in Australia, do you think the government is doing enough about whatever thing they care about? They're going to say no a lot of the time because there is a bit of a lack of trust and a bit of a lack of connection between you know government policy and the needs of young people in particular. And that's the majority of the people we spoke to for this report were at festivals. There were a lot of younger people who were pretty disillusioned with politics. Mm-hmm. But the other part of it is just that like a lot of the business models that music has kind of built itself around are sort of just falling apart. They're not really functioning properly particularly post-pandemic, but even just the pandemic accelerated things that were already happening, like a decrease in alcohol consumption, just kind of exposing how much live music has relied on alcohol sales over the years to kind of function financially. Mm-hmm. It's all a bunch of stuff that's happening with music that's kind of in real time breaking down in a financial and economic perspective. Yeah. So I think when people say like, oh, I wish the government would do more to save music from climate change or from whatever, I think it's hinting at a little bit of a just general dysfunction in terms of how we kind of think about music and how we fund it broadly.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So I guess in a way you're kind of saying we need to kind of take a relook at, I guess, like different sectors of how we operate in the industry as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's one thing to say like, hey, if you want these big mega outdoor festivals to exist, then we might need to reform insurance and reform the way that that they, you know, maybe they will need some heavy subsidization from funding programs. Mm-hmm. But I think the other part of the question is to think about, okay, well, how does music work at a grassroots level? None of that stuff, those big festivals, exist without grassroots music and cultural institutions and activity. And how is all of that being funded at the moment? And to say mm-hmm. that, you know, to say that big festivals are at risk from climate change, I mean, really everything is at risk in the climate crisis. It's
yeah.
making all sorts of things precarious and untenable, or it's revealing cracks and fault lines that were already existing in our systems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it's when I see a stat like that, you know, to me it's just a reminder that, you know, a new generation or new generations are coming through that see those fault lines, that want to expose those fault lines and want to work towards potentially new ideas and reform and experimenting with different models. It may not be the existing institutions that pull us out of the mess that we're in.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess I was also interested in, I know that was kind of more, I guess, a government-focused solutions. I know you did mention grassroots as well and community organisations. But I was just wondering, did anything in the report kind of, I guess, like, did anything in the that was like a finding from a report spark some new ideas in other kinds of solutions that might be viable? Sorry, that was a bit like terribly worded, but took a while to get there. But if you understand what I'm saying.
I do. I think I do. I'm not sure if it sparked any like specific ideas or specific. I think it's just it. If anything, it reminded us, and hopefully will remind anybody who checks that report out, that there is this desire for change, and that there is an acknowledgement that there's some things that are broken, and that's you know it's not the music sector alone that faces that challenge and that has that. Has things to address, but I don't know. I think for me personally, like I'm always going to kind of try and refocus back in that grassroots level, because I think really that's where the foundation of the change that we need is going to occur. I guess even the stat you pulled out is probably one of my favorite stats for that reason, because it just shows that people. They feel like the traditional means of creating change, like some of the stories we've been told over the years in terms of how change happens, they feel like maybe that is not enough.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I guess I hope that music and other parts of the climate movement and just broadly different forms of issues-based advocacy and social justice can really find ways to harness that community energy and give people places to organise and gather and structures within which they can support each other to, you know, change the way that they feel, the way they behave, and then work towards putting that social pressure back on some of those stakeholders, whether it might be government or corporate or otherwise.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it kind of just goes back to what we were saying before about festivals and live music events being community-centered events. So I think having a community like orientated solution is great for them. I guess when we talk about these grassroots or community-based solutions, does this have like does this take any like certain form or action?
I think with music in particular, or just more broadly?
I guess more broadly. Like, I suppose if listeners are people who frequent live music events or festivals, what could action from them look like to see, I guess, more music festivals stay alive in the future?
Well, I mean, just simply taking more of an interest in climate as an issue, you know, is a starting point, and getting involved in whatever form of community or advocacy group feels right to you. I mean, we are one of those groups, Green Music Australia. We have our own kind of volunteer base and our own community base. So you could sign up at our website and start coming along to some of our meetups and get involved with some of our actions and some of our campaigns. But there's so many different groups like that now that you can get involved in, depending on your flavour of thing that you're interested in. Like the AYCC, for example, the Australian Youth Climate Council, is just about to launch their kind of annual Step Up for Climate campaign, which activates young people all around the country to get physically active in order to raise money for climate outcomes. You have organisations like traditional organisations like the Australian Conservation Foundation and Greenpeace, or the Bob Brown Foundation, the Wilderness Society. I mean, there really are like so many different groups that you can get involved in if you want to take that next step. Rising Tide, for example, based out of Newcastle, but increasingly across the whole country, doing amazing things, sparking up direct action and just properly educating communities and getting them involved. If you want to come to Newcastle at the end of this month for the People's Blockade that Rising Tide is organising, that's one way to get involved. Yeah. It can be a bit overwhelming when you look at all the options, but there are so many different kinds of things you can do. And I guess, the thing is that I would generally say is, like, as a person who loves music, there's things you can be doing. You can be taking public transport to gigs instead of driving, or you can be conscious of your kind of vinyl and T-shirt purchases. Make sure that if you are going to do that kind of consumption, that you're doing it in an environmentally responsible way. Support artists who are speaking up on social issues. There's a lot you can do about it as a music fan, in the same way that as an individual you can look at, you know, what are you consuming and what are you putting in the bin, and, you know, what kind of car do you drive, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's more than just that individual behaviour. It's about how do we pull together as communities, and how do we pull together and connect together. Mm-hmm. I think that's where the actual change will occur, not just, you know, us making sure that we're ticking every box individually.
Yeah, no, definitely, for sure. I think, you know, everyone can play an individual part, but it works better when we're all together and we're kind of all on the same page about these things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess as well, just touching on just Green Music Australia as a whole again, I know you've led like events and campaigns in the past. I know you specifically had led the No Music on a Dead Planet campaign, which saw over, I believe it was like 1,000 musicians in Australia sign up to call for urgent climate action during the last federal election. I guess, what was the inspiration behind doing that?
Well, No Music on a Dead Planet, which some of your listeners may or may not have heard of already, is essentially a global campaign. It kicked off, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago in the UK from an amazing drummer. Her name's Faye Milton, and she basically cooked up this slogan, which is a variation of existing kind of, impact slogans, No Music on a Dead Planet. And she started printing it on T-shirts. She started giving it out to her friends and bands, and it just kind of took on a life of its own. There's something about that phrase, No Music on a Dead Planet, that actually does seem to cut through with a lot of people, and just makes them kind of stop and think and reassess. When you're like involved in climate 24/7, you take all this stuff for granted, but there's still a lot of people just not really generally thinking about it. And when they see you across the supermarket aisle wearing this really intimidating T-shirt that says No Music on a Dead Planet, you know, I have people come up to me and talk to me about it. They'll go, "What is the deal with your T-shirt?" What, like, yeah. I don't know. It sparks conversation. So as much as like I sometimes feel a little skeptical of advocacy and activism that's just based around like a hashtag or something, but it has been quite a powerful movement. So, yeah, excuse me, at the start of this year, we did decide to kind of activate that message because we kind of, Green Music Australia kind of represents that campaign in Australia. And we decided, look, how can we, if we can have any impact at all as a music community on the election result, we're a charity, so we can't tell people how to vote. We're not allowed to. we'd risk our charity status.
Yep.
But what we can do is we can say, yeah, well, we can encourage you to look at the options and make sure that you're making an informed choice for the planet and for on climate issues. So that's what we really did with the No Music on a Dead Planet campaign. And I think this is something about, you know, who you vote for does matter.
Yeah.
And your vote is important. And there was something about that meant that we could activate a lot of our relationships with artists at that community level and also some of those more mainstream figures as well, and get them talking about, and potentially even get some of them talking about the election when they might not otherwise have done so, because it was this apolitical message of like, oh, you know, we had artists saying, oh, we're not going to tell you who to vote for, but if you care about the planet, do your research.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what impact we have, we're not sure, but we definitely got that message out to a lot of people and hopefully, you know, had some impact.
Yeah. No, I think for sure, I feel for sure it would have had a lot of impact on a lot of people, because it kind of goes back again to like what we were saying about people kind of seeing their favorite musicians or seeing their artists who have a platform and, you know, starting to think around, okay, if they're platforming their belief saying, you know, look at who you're going to vote for, like look at their policies. Other people are going to start to follow through as well.
It's just that there's a lot of people who just aren't thinking about this stuff on the day-to-day, which is fair enough. But if we can use music as a way to reach those people and say, well, okay, stop and have a think about it, that's really important. I mean, the tricky thing is that, you know, this is a bit where I have to be careful exactly how I say this, but you know, the reality is that our federal government, the Albanese government, is approving coal and gas extensions, is not necessarily. So it's not like, oh, we did that and then we have now elected a government that's, it's all rosy and great. Like, no, the work continues. There's still so much work to do. But outside of even the election result, hopefully that kind of campaign, which we only do that every now and then, really. Hopefully that campaign just raises awareness, it gets people thinking, it gets people acting.
Yeah.
It's kind of, sometimes it can feel like, two steps forward, one step back. But.
Yeah, it's still nice to have a go though, or try. Better than not doing anything. I suppose as well, does Green Music Australia have any upcoming events or, I guess, campaigns, or if, I don't know, maybe if listeners are interested in seeing more of what you do?
100%. Yeah. I mean, if you are interested, the best thing to do is go to our website, greenmusic.org.au, or come find us at Instagram. If you go to our website and sign up, then you'll be on our newsletter, which means that you get all of the communications and updates about events when we put them on. We do actually have, I run like regular online calls for people who want to just learn a bit more about us and connect to other people who are interested in music and climate. And there's one of them coming up in just a couple of weeks' time. So that's like, it's essentially a Zoom call and you can dial in from anywhere. That's a couple of weeks from now. The details for that are also on our Instagram, which is, a good place to find out about stuff we're doing. And hopefully, I think before the end of the year, we'll put on an event in Brunswick, which will be a combination of live music and climate talks and panels, but we haven't quite announced that yet. So you'll have to sign up to our newsletter and our communications on our website to find out about that when we announce it.
So now you've kind of got to keep an eye out.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I know, especially so last minute that I contacted you, but thank you so much. It was really great to hear from you and about Green Music Australia and your report. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thank you.
Hello there, I'm Virginia from The Gardening Show. What if there was a viable solution to climate change? Treasured Perennials Nursery are sponsoring a screening of Kiss the Ground documentary, exploring how, through our soils, we can stabilise the Earth's climate, restore lost ecosystems, and provide future food security. A mini event with stalls, demonstrations, and a Q&A session. It's going to be at Ferny Creek Horticultural Society, which is in Hilton Road in Sassafras, on November the 15th, 11:30 to 4 p.m. Tickets will be $15.50 through TryBooking. Head to trybooking.com and search for Kiss the Ground. All proceeds, of course, are donated to 3CR. Treasured Perennials Nursery is a 3CR supporter and regularly appear on The Gardening Show.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high-quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Fire! Brr. Hi, this is Cheryl Lee Hood. You're invited to the 2025 Beyond the Bars CD launch on Thursday, the 20th of November at the Deering Centre next to Collingwood Town Hall. Put it in your diaries. I'll be there as MC for an evening of talks and music, including a panel discussion with some of our deadly broadcasters and music with Mr. Bar Willoughby. Thursday, the 20th of November, the Deering Centre, next to Collingwood Town Hall, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Free CDs, snacks and drinks provided. All welcome. See you there. Brr.
You're listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network, either 3CR or Skid Row. We just spoke with Tim Shield, the community organiser from Green Music Australia, about their recent report from early this year, the Rain, Heat and Repeat report, talking about how climate change and extreme weather is influencing consumer behaviour and ticket buying purchases for live music and festival events, and how climate change overall is risking the really important community and cultural spaces that those festivals provide, I guess not just here in Australia, but worldwide, and what some of the solutions to those look. So if you're just tuning in now and you'd be really interested in hearing that chat, no worries, you didn't miss out, luckily. You can head over to 3cr.org.au and go to the Climate Action Show page. A copy of this show will be uploaded to the show after the program tonight. But for the rest of the show, we have a chat with Shay, who is a new member to our Climate Action team, which is really exciting. So it's great that she's here tonight. And we'll be having a chat a bit about how people and festivals themselves can contribute to a more sustainable and eco-friendly event building space. Because festivals in themselves, although they are being threatened by climate change, are also big contributors to that themselves. So I was speaking with Shay a little earlier today about a festival that she had heard of and knows people who had gone to, that was quite a good example of this.
Yeah, so I haven't actually been to the festival, but it is called Waking Life. It is in Portugal. It runs for a week in June as a music festival. And the other days of the year, they're engaged in a land regeneration project. So I'll just read a bit of their online blurb, like what this means. So for 6 days in June, people gather for the festival. For the other 359 days of the year, we are engaged in a land regeneration project that is aimed at turning the 35-hectare festival grounds into a biodiverse public park where flora and fauna grow into vibrant new ecosystems. They go on to say that this project is a laboratory for figuring out new ways of growing and knowing, consuming and celebrating, transforming and terraforming. It is an experimental garden for cultivating new models of interaction between cultural productions, regenerative practitioners and local communities. In essence, the Waking Life Landcare Project and Festival are an intertwined, emergent collective practice for possible, earthier, healthier, wetter futures. So what I sort of took from this was, is it possible for festivals to become more community world-building spaces themselves? So moving beyond like sustainability and extreme weather protection, infrastructure and communication, and also moving beyond sort of insurance and subsidies, but also actively engaging communities to contribute year-round to the ecology of the surrounds in which the festivals take place. So, less relying on lobbying governments to do more and put the power sort of and responsibility back to the people in a way. And by this, I don't mean sort of doing greenwashing tactics of not using plastic straws or recycling when you're at a festival, but I mean sort of actively engaging community in projects of care, like what this festival does. I think the Waking Life in Portugal, you should look them up. They're really fantastic. But they plant a lot of trees throughout the year. They have a vegetable garden. All of the food waste from the festival is turned into compost for this garden. Wood leftovers from construction get turned into wood chips and used as brown material. So they're doing some really cool stuff. And the community around the place where it's held are really involved with the festival and have an active role in sort of what the festival looks like. So, which got me thinking how this kind of similar ethos could be brought to Australian festivals, because I think a big part, for me, a big part of the solution to climate change is not sort of just switching to renewables or becoming more sustainable, although this stuff is certainly very important. But I think a big thing is that we have to sort of change our relationships and our ways of living and existing with each other, with our environment, with non-humans, with food, with products, with resources. In my eyes, there has to be a big fundamental shift in how we live and how we compose relationships. And it seems like festivals are often these very kind of fleeting moments in time. Obviously, yeah, not for the organisers or volunteers or people working on them. Yeah. But certainly for those attending them, you kind of have this relationship with them that only lasts for a day or for a weekend or a short period of time. And they're kind of, yeah, these hedonistic spaces, which I think is really great. But it might be an idea to give this form of hedonism more care and nurture and support so it can continue, especially if it's a festival that happens in your area and transforms the environment that you live in for a short part of the year. I'm just sort of interested in considering if there's more we as a community can do for these important music festivals that go beyond government support and just sort of being conscious of being sustainable. I'm sure there probably are many festivals like this in Australia, especially maybe First Nations festivals. And I understand it might not be easy for an already existing festival to take this form, especially, you know, if they don't own the land they run on or have the resources to, I guess, create more ecological spaces throughout the year. But yeah, I think it's definitely something to think about, how we can change our relationships to live music events, because, I mean, you sort of said it a bit earlier, but what's the purpose of them? Why do people attend music festivals? Partly, I think, to see the music you like, but also partly because of the community building aspect of it. To be surrounded by like-minded people, and to be part of something for this brief moment. So I think it makes sense that we should try to nurture these community building spaces and the environment they exist in so that they can continue. And something else I thought while listening to the interview was that you sort of mentioned that music festivals might be like, the threat of music festivals might be one of the lesser risks of climate change, in that there will be a lot of really horrible, terrible consequences for people. And it kind of seems a bit minuscule, this threat of music festivals. But when you kind of look at the big picture and you think about what is really being threatened, it's community spaces. And I think that's not really a minuscule threat at all. Mm-hmm. So those were my thoughts on on this topic, but yeah.
No, I think that's super interesting. I also think, with the community spaces thing, because I also just think that even goes back to just like, even just protesting, threatening like the ability for people to gather and get together, which, yeah, I think it goes back to, even though it seems like a music festival, not that big of a deal, I think if you look at the bigger picture, yeah, it's like, it is quite concerning.
Yeah.
But I also think the festival is really interesting that you spoke about, because I think it really, I guess it kind of shows, again, like with that community thing, how do you really embody the community aspect of a festival? How do you be what people want it to be like, what people want to see? And I think having people contribute, like, I think people would be more interested in that as well.
Yeah. I don't know how, this sort of reminded me of a festival that was, when I lived in London, there was a festival that was in a park next to my house. And I remember just thinking, watching them put up the festival, that this is going to be awful because this is where I like to sit and read, and they're going to make this park really muddy and it's just going to be unusable for a couple of weeks in the summer. And I remember being really angry about it. But what the festival did was they gave free tickets to sort of people in this radius around the festival so that those people could enjoy it. So I think that's sort of just one very small example. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I think there needs to be more thought into how communities can shape festivals that aren't just sort of shaping them in this very fleeting moment of time, but actually sort of contributing to the community aspect, but also to the environmental aspect of them and how they transform environments. Because basically the result of climate change is that environments are going to be utterly transformed, and we need to learn how to exist in these utterly transformed spaces. And I think being a part of a transforming space and making sure that space is throughout the year continuously nurtured, I think that maybe is something that we could think about. But again, I don't know how this would really work in a big context of like Falls or Falls Festival, or these really massive, massive festivals that, I mean, probably for them, like Tim said, the main thing would be subsidies and insurance and infrastructure.
For sure. I think that that support is probably very important. I think a really key aspect, because I think a lot of festivals and live music events already, I think one of the main things they're suffering from and struggling with is the money, is the cost of everything. So while I think it would be great to have like this festival here in Australia that, you know, it's sort of like it owns the land it's on, and then throughout the whole year you're kind of working on that land. It becomes like a, like you were saying, like it's a whole thing. Like it's not just a fleeting moment. It's sort of hard. I don't even think they'd have the money to buy the land.
Yeah.
Yeah, considering everything else. But yeah, I think it is a good idea though.
It's a great idea, but then when you think about, okay, how do we put that in practice? And how do festivals that already exist put that in practice? It's like, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I do think like it is just interesting to think about that relational aspect of it, and that it is not just climate. I think the whole aspect of climate change, not just being about kind of governments and money and COP, and I mean, I could go on and on about COP and what I think of it, but it is more, I think, a lot of the conversation as well has to be about how we change relationships and the systems with which we compose relationships. And yeah, I think that kind of can apply to this festival landscape if we really try to think about it. But each festival and each landscape would call for a very different solution and response, maybe. And each community, of course, as well, would call for a very different response.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be something that has an answer. It would be something that has a very geographically and community context answer.
It'd be sort of dependent, I suppose. But you said something just before that I think is really interesting as well, and it's like, not always it's kind of like focusing on what we can do as a community. Because I think a lot of the times there's this sentiment that it's like, yeah, like, you know, the community can do things. But the real issue is with like the governments or the companies. And if they don't do anything, nothing's going to get done, which I completely understand. Obviously, they kind of hold more power in this regard. But I think it's also a bad thing to get caught up in the idea that we can't do anything. You need to, you know, like, I think, and that nihilism kind of destroys like any action, any possible action, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting because, yeah, you don't want to just sort of put all the hand, like all the sort of stakes in the government. And also people often talk about putting the stakes in philanthropy as well. I had a conversation with someone the other day who said, who was talking about King Charles and him putting loads of money into climate change and climate change research and how this is just like the solution. And I just wanted to be like, philanthropy is not the solution. Like, it's part of it, but it is, there's many other like sort of solutions. And I don't want to sound like a greenwasher when I say communities should do more, because obviously I don't believe that, like, believe that switching to you know, bamboo straws or this kind of thing is like, yeah, it's the corporations, it's their fault, and it is governments that have a lot of power. But yeah, like you said about the nihilism, I think sometimes we can get really overwhelmed with like who has the power and where the power balance is, and it's really hard to kind of consider how you can do something quite active that's going to make a difference individually. I don't really know sort of how to answer, I guess. All I can think of is that community. I just keep coming back to community. Maybe because we're on community radio.
Everything comes back to community. I think so, though. I think it's something that like people take for granted. It's something that's kind of overlooked, but I think at the core of everything, it's kind of where you always come back to: community, belonging. I just believe that that really is the core of everything.
And I think it's important to highlight community isn't just community between humans and sort of other people, community with non-humans, community with food, with resources, like relationships in community come from not just human to human interaction. So I think understanding community as a place that involves your surrounds and that involves other aspects that aren't just relationships with other people, I think can also help to kind of change, to shift our perception of what we think of as community and how we can nurture community that's not just nurturing relationships with other people.
Unfortunately, we are pretty much out of time here on the Climate Action Show tonight, but it's been a really interesting night. It's been really great. If you want to go back and listen to anything or you missed out on anything, again, you can go to 3cr.org.au, and a podcast version of this episode will be uploaded onto our page, Climate Action Show. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight, and thank you so much to Tim Shield from Green Music Australia for coming on for an interview to talk about their Rain, Heat, Repeat report. There'll also be a copy of that report uploaded onto our page as well that has the podcast. So if you're interested, you could check it out for yourself. I've been Bella, and there's also been Shay tonight, our new member from the Climate Action team. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for Breadline on next, and we'll be back 5 p.m. next week, next Monday. Dreaming of an aspect bright and fair, learning myself.
Hi, everyone.